Ghost Hunting in New England,
your favorite spooky podcast. Hello and happy Wednesday. Welcome to this week's episode of Ghost Hunting in New England with your hosts Amelia
and Beth.
And today we are doing something a little unique. While we do interviews on the show, they're usually ghost related. But today we are interviewing Tom Reed of the Berkshire UFO incident, which many of you, if you're into UFOs, you definitely know who this person is. But even if you're not into UFOlogy, and you're listening to our show, chances are you've probably watched Unsolved Mysteries. And he was on it. And so we are going to talk to him about his experiences. And yeah, so Tom, thank you so much for being on our show.
Hey, thanks for having me. I've waited for this one for a while because you're actually based in Massachusetts. So it's super cool. And you were just at my park. So that makes it, you know, really interesting to me. So I'm going to have questions for you too. So I guess we'll just jump in. I guess for your listeners, I should just, start with what happened. A lot of people don't realize that there was a lot of activity in the area. It just wasn't 1969. And there still is. You know, there's crop circles in 2013 and 14. There's spheres being seen over the fields even recently.
Out in that area?
Yeah, it's right near my park. It's all within a couple of miles of my park. Yeah, it's very active. Yeah. And so 1974, there was a lot of activity. Our first sighting or what we first encountered was 1966. I was really little. So with that, when we talked about it, or my mother talked about it in a diner, of course, that didn't go over very big because we were New Yorkers. You know, we weren't local to Massachusetts and we had moved into a small town. And so we were outsiders to begin with. So this, you know, went over like a lead balloon in the diner, right? So we stopped talking about it for a while. And then in 1967, my mother and grandmother were involved in an episode that took place in our house. You know, we saw, lights flashing, and I saw this bluish, ring or sphere outside my bedroom window. It fired a light into our room. Our light was completely engulfed. Our room just, it was like being hit by an ocean wave. That was pretty much the first up close and personal thing that ever physically affected me. So to give you a better idea, I was laying on my bed looking out the window, and I saw that like a hula hoop of a white and blue ring. So I'm looking, trying to get around the ladder, looking at this thing, and I just, bang, it was like I got hit. It really felt like an ocean wave. I felt like I was standing up. I was inverted. I felt like I was flipped around. My brother was on the top bunk. And that's really the first thing that I'll never forget that, you know. And my mother found my brother and I outside in the driveway, you know, not that much longer. You know, she actually found us outside. And my brother and I were staring at each other in like a placid, very placid manner. Not responding. I remember her grabbing my brother and bringing us into the kitchen and giving us baby aspirin and juice. And she laid my brother on the love seat, put me on a sofa, and started a fire. And back in the day, they used to have the stuff you put in your hand, you throw it in the fire, and it would change colors. The flames would change colors, trying to get us to respond. And I remember that. But according to her, we were just not ourselves. We were just, you know, completely removed, detached.
Do you remember that feeling of, did you want to talk? Were you just unable to? Were you in shock?
You know what I remember? I remember sitting at the kitchen table, and my brother had soda top, like twist off the soda bottle tops, and he just kept playing with it, spinning it, not responding, just, but I remember him doing that, and he remembers himself doing that. But we don't know why we weren't really, you know, it was almost like surreal, you know, like we were there, but we weren't there. And so that particular night, my mother was so concerned about what happened that she took it back to the diner and would talk about it in her diner. And it was the only eatery. If you've ever been to Sheffield, you probably have driven through it at some point. And we had the only little restaurant there. So you know, the farmers didn't, you know, during school or what have you, the school buses didn't go to their farms. They just went to the main street. So the parents would all just say, you know, screw it. We'll just take all our kids to Reed's Diner and they can eat there and I'll walk across to school together. And so we had the jukebox and they ran a tab for all these kids. So the following day after this, our diner, even though school wasn't open, a lot of kids still hung out at our diner. It was the only place to listen to music, right? WSBS was an AM station. There was no music, so the diner was a place to hang. And so in the afternoon, the kids would hang out at the diner and ride their banana seat bikes around that little area there. And my mother started talking to the parents, you know, hey, this happened again. You know, I don't know what to do. I'm 29 years old. I'm a single mother. You know, this is, you know, she was trying to relate to people, get some advice, you know, get mm-hmm. some support. And it backfired on her. It just became, you know, mudslinging, you know, and it was very tough for her. And so we, you know, if you watch Unsolved Mysteries, they said, well, you know, nobody really ever talked about it. That's not true. The walls of our diner, that's where all the talk took place. Outside our diner? No. It's kind of like being in church, right? You could talk to God in church, but if you start talking to God in Walmart, they're going to take you away, right? So mm-hmm. it was kind of like that, you know? It was kind of like inside the walls of our diner, have at it. You know, people, there were fights, there were people push and shove situations, everything. And so our diner was the hub. And so after realizing that this wasn't doing us any good, you know, fights were starting to, you know, people were avoiding the diner. It was getting divided by different families, you know. And of course, you had the racetrack in town, Great Barrington Horse Track. So you had a lot of New Yorkers coming in to bet on the track, and it was just a disaster. And so we shut up about it. And then in 1969, I was riding a horse at Ski Butternut, and my mother said, you know, let's head home, let's close up the diner because our cook was working there at night. Went in, made the night deposit drop. It was dusk. It was about a half an hour or so after Melanie had run into the UFO at Lake Mansfield. She ran into it about 8 o'clock with her parents. They were in a car four near the water. And now we were in the station wagon, four people heading over water. And it was going in our direction. So we kind of collided with it. We kind of went, hit it head on. And so we head out of the diner. We were going down Route 7, cut across this bridge. And the first thing that my grandmother recognized or noticed was lights coming up from the planks of the boards of the bridge. And she didn't say anything about it at that point, but she mentioned it later. And we, about the time we got to the middle of the bridge, we just felt different. It was ominous, you know, something was off. And by the time we came out the backside of the bridge, I was giving my brother a candy and my grandmother turned around to make, you know, to mention you could choke or what have you. That's, I remember that very well. And because she was turned around, she saw the sphere over the water. She was the first one to see it. And so she's staring at the sphere, and we're only going about 10 or 15 miles an hour, very bumpy dirt road. And so my mom saw it too, but she was driving, and she's basically seeing it in the mirror of her car. And so this thing just kind of, I'd say it was about a story or so off the water. I've never said it came out of the water. I don't know where it came from. But it was hovering right there. But then again, there was a bleed of light under the board. So, you know, I'm not quite sure how that happened, if it was a reflection. But the light, when I saw it, was very self-contained. It was not bleeding. It wasn't like a bleed of light. It was like a glowing cue ball from a pool table. Is okay. What it looked. It looked solid. I used to say it looked like a bubble because of how tight it was wrapped. Mm-hmm. But it illuminated And so about a story up, these rods, one rod came firing from the center of this cue ball sphere on the left side and on the right side. So if you saw Ancient Aliens, they showed it looking like an ice cream cone. And for a second or two, it actually did look like a sugar cone. It had these rods that fired in. I don't know how many there were. I don't think there was as many as they showed on Ancient Aliens, but at least two or three. And then they dissolved. And the thing kind of just rose up and started going in the same direction as our car, but there was a line of trees between us. And so we kind of lost sight of it for a little bit, but you could still see this glow, and then it faded out and we couldn't see it anymore. But it was still behind the trees. So we're looking for it. My brother on the right of me noticed an orange sphere, very much like it, off to the right, also over water. and it had a roll to it again. It had that ocean wave kind of roll, but it was orangey and yellow. It looked like the sun, like the inside of a sun. And I don't think it was as big as the white one, but it the center of this one was turning. And I only saw it for maybe, I don't know, 6 or 7 seconds. It wasn't more than that because we were moving. I saw it, but I remember it looked like lava, you know, that. whereas that one was solid. And so at this point, we actually have one to the right, which I would say would be about, you know, 5 o'clock. And then the one on the left, which would have been about 7 o'clock from our car. Okay. And as we went forward, we started to feel like we were deep underwater, like muffled. My mother said it was like the air got tight, like pressure on your lungs or something. But I felt like I was submerged at the bottom of a swimming pool. And that tapping noise, you know, when you're in a pool, you hear that tapping noise that echoes through the pool. Mm-hmm. Well, we heard tapping sounds, and I used to think it was stones underneath the back fender wall of the car, but we heard like that. Again, as a child, not thinking of anything else, I referenced things that, you know, I was familiar with, and that's what it sounded like to me. And all of a sudden, it was like we were out of it again, you know, like we were aware, but in this funk. And as my mother pulled the car off to the right, there was a telephone pole there, so there was a little bit more room, and that's where we stopped. And off to the left was this open area of the park. You've been to the park, so you know when you go down that dirt road, on the left there it's all open. So since you know the park, you've walked that road, right?
Yes.
A little bit? Okay. Do you see, you know when you got past the clearing, there's a telephone pole there, it's all open, but you can still see where there used to be water? It's like it was all pockets where there would just be a river back there, a body of water.
Yes.
Well, that's where we first saw this craft, this like a disc, more of a disc-shaped object, okay?
Okay.
Now, the center of it was twice as fat as the top and the bottom combined. So the middle of it was the lion's share of it, and it was flat. It was like a snake skin around the outside of it. It was fat. The top was thinner. The bottom was thinner. And the shell or the skin of it actually looked as if it was putting out some type of a sheen itself. So it wasn't the light on the bottom of it that got our attention. It was the goldish, the orangey colors, the silver swirls like the pewter, the mix of shades. And as we're looking out the window of the car, the right side of it was brighter than the left. And for the longest time, we're thinking, well, could that have been the moonlight, you know, from where the moon was hitting it? But no, this thing was actually putting out its own, like an energy, a light that bled through. Now picture this. So we've got the disc was up at like maybe 11 o'clock, then of course 5 and 7. So we were in the middle of a triangle.
Oh, interesting. And how big was the craft?
You know, I used to say, oh, it's 100 yards easy because my son played football, right?
Yeah.
But I go back there and I look, and it was. It had to be at least that big because I look at that field and I'm like, it took up so much of it. And my mother saw it. My grandmother saw it. I'm going to say it was right around 100 yards. And it was massive. This was not a small, you know, people saw it was like 30, 40. No, this thing was friggin' big. And even Jan Green, when she saw it, she couldn't even see the sides of it. So whatever this was friggin' big. And again, so we're in the middle of these three objects. And I think they were communicating. I think that there was something going on and we were caught in the middle of it and why we felt the way we did. Now, as we're looking at the disc or what have you, my mother was in the driver's seat looking out. Their windows were open. The car was running. The headlights were on. Very important. My grandmother was also trying to see around my mother. And my brother and I were all looking, and we were all staring out the windows at this thing. All of a sudden, it was kind of like someone switched life off. It was just like, boom, dead silent. Then all of a sudden, the car lit up like in 67 when our room lit up like that. It wasn't like a dome light. I mean, this was just like, wham. It was just like you could see the knobs. You could see the floor of the radio. You could see the door handles, my back of my mother's head, you could see that. I mean, it was just a car was just like brilliantly lit up. And then katydids, crickets, and boom, nothing. And that's really the last thing I remember. So we went from whatever this was had changed the environment, had altered the environment. It got almost surreal. It was almost like we were there but not there, kind of that feeling. And then all of a sudden, bam, back to normal. And when it came back to normal, the wildlife responded. You know, crickets, frogs, you could hear the you could hear the life on that road again. Now, you've gone down that road. You've heard it, you know, the crickets. It was like someone just went and turned everything off and then turned everything back on. And when I found myself in what looked like an airplane hangar, and I've said an airplane hangar because my mother and father were pilots. They weren't married at the time, but, well. And that's what this room reminded me of. There were singular tubes of light where the wall met the ceiling. And it was like a light, a space, a light, a space. It reminded me of fluorescent tubes. I'm not saying they were. You know, it was pretty empty. There was enough light in there that I could see, but not very, very lit up. I was by myself, as far as I knew. I had slid off some type of a table and landed on my feet. And there was an opening. I've said a door of some kind, but there was an opening. And I saw a figure come in, somewhat come in, and then something grabbed my arm. So I wasn't alone, although I thought I was. And I was taken out this door and gone down a hallway, which was very tall walls, white, bleeding. You know, reminded me of a, you know, I was going from dark to light, so it looked very bright to me. And I can still see it in my head. You know, I can still see this door. It was like twice the size of a normal door. It wasn't a door that you opened. It was a doorway. Okay. And I was taken out, taken out to the right, not too far down, took a left, bang, I was in this room where this wall bowed in like a glass wall. Like I've had an MRI, you know, that kind of thing where you've got that glass and it looked very medical. And I was sitting on this table type thing. And I saw these like insect looking, they had heads like a red fire ant. It was about the size of a football. Their bodies were, looked like a mushroom color, a teardrop body. The legs were like bamboo. There was two of them. They were actually, it was weird because they were just facing the wall. It was like they were only like a foot away from the wall looking at something in this wall. There was two of them. And I jumped off this table. I ran out into a hallway, which was like an empty Walmart. It was that big. And I was brought back into this room. And there was an apparatus in the ceiling. I remember that. And
can I interrupt you just for a second? How were you brought into the room? Did someone come and get you and like physically escort you back in? Were you just...
Same way. I was grabbed by my left arm. I was only grabbed left arm twice. So when I was in this, and I'll tell you, this open area that I ran out to, was like round, and it had gray like markings on it, not black but gray markings on the ground, and it had three intersecting hallways. Mm-hmm. And I was right near the right hallway off to the right. It was like if you took a Y, the letter, and placed it right over a circle. So the top of the Y's were much thinner, like maybe a 2-lane road. Mm-hmm. And bottom of the Y to my left was like a 4-lane road. And I always thought that where I was meant to, control the flow of traffic, coming from one, going to another, because how the two smaller ones fed to the larger one or vice versa.
Okay.
That's what it was like. And so where I was much bigger than the craft we saw. The room alone, the hallway alone that's why I'm very careful how I word things, because I don't know where I was, but it was much bigger than that craft. Okay. And so when we came to in the car, I remember hearing my mother's voices. I remember people. My brother remembers something very similar to me. He was not with me at the time, although Discovery Channel showed him next to me, but he wasn't. And so we're back in the car. I was not awake yet. My grandmother was the first one to come to. But my grandmother was now in the driver's seat, and the car was off, mm-hmm. and the headlights were off. Mm. So two things before I jump ahead. Either somebody walked by our car and shut it off because it was idling with nobody in it for several hours, mm-hmm. or that was human error and there was some form of government involved in who extracted us from the vehicle. Because when we got taken from the vehicle, we were like, boom, we were like that flash. We were like out of it. So I don't know how we left the vehicle. Right. And I don't know how we got back. And where we were was bigger than the craft. And the car was, ignition was off. And my mother and grandmother were reversed.
So when you say like human error and government interference, do you think the government had a part in this?
Absolutely. We've always really? Had. But the whole community does. Mostly everybody does. And I'll get to that later too. But I'll tell you this. Did you know that the magnesium for the atom bomb was mined 3 miles from my park?
No, I did not know that.
You've got Command Aerospace, mm-hmm. Pratt, Sikorsky, General Electric, Groton Naval Base, nuclear submarine base over there, right?
Yeah.
And you got the...
There's a nuclear submarine base in Western Massachusetts?
Connecticut, right on the shore.
Okay. Electric boat. All right.
And so the other thing, too, that gets mentioned to us a lot is that 9 of us are Rh negative, and most of us are A negative or O negative. And O negative blood is the only blood tracked by the U.S. government because it was the universal donor during those years of Vietnam, which is when basically what's happened. So when we were born, our blood types, which is, seems to be of interest to those who have experiences in the UFO community, the R negative blood or Rh negative blood seems to be a common thing. I don't know if you knew that or not.
I have that kind of blood. Are they still tracing it?
It's the universal donor.
Well,
it's the only blood that can be given everybody. So, I believe it is. You might want to Google it, but yeah, I believe it is.
Okay, cool.
So our family, our body temperature runs at 97.1. So when I was younger, would go to the doctor and I'd have a 99 degree temperature. It's 2 points to me, but I couldn't even get an antibiotic until I completely spiked. So I bet yours runs lower than normal.
Yeah, it does.
Mm-hmm. See? And Time Magazine did an article once about the only group of people that tested higher with regard to coincidental chance or remote viewing were those with the Rh negative blood groups. Hmm. Now, there is something different. We're a little different. We're like a different species within a species. You know, your blood type shouldn't drive a 2 degree change in body temperature.
No, it should not. But is that, that's really true that when I get my temperature taken, it's usually in the low 97s. And I've had the same problem that I've gone to the doctor because I've had like a 99.5. And they're you're fine. I'm like, no, I'm not fine.
You feel like because you're 2.5 points above normal.
Right.
And so anyone else, that would be like 101.
Yeah, 101. If I was at 101, you would do something about this, right?
Mm-hmm. And they're just starting to look into that more now. So
I'll be interested to hear what you find out.
Okay. Well, here's something else of interest too. So for you to be Rh negative, I'm getting off track here, but it's a second. For you to be Rh negative, that means your father and mother had to be.
Yep.
Right. Do you know how rare it is to be Rh negative? It's only 13% of the entire world, and most of them are Bostonians. So for us, which is probably why you're more sensitive. You're more sensitive than most people too, right? You pick up things, you see things, you feel things,
sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Well,
we all like to think that we're more observant than everyone else, right?
Well, we are. You are.
Okay.
Look it up. I'm telling you. So we think that was part of the reason that maybe we were singled out or what have you, because – you know, it's a small community. There's only 3,000 people live in that town of Sheffield. And here we are, like 9 of us collectively as a family, all Rh negative, most of A negative and O negative. And so that's one of the things that we're like, well, why? What, you know, why would you be singled out if you were? Or was it just coincidental? But it wouldn't happen twice at our farm, on our property, if it was a coincidental chance, right?
Right.
So anyway, this is where it gets kind of bizarre again. So, so my grandmother is now in a driver's seat. My mother is out completely, not responding to anything. She couldn't wake her up. I was out. My brother's head was now on my leg. So if when we got put in the vehicle, obviously I was put in before my brother because his head was on top of me. Okay. My grandmother, I said on the show, she never drove. My grandmother didn't even have a car. She had a driver's license. She could drive, and she did on occasion, but she never really drove because she didn't have a car. So now she's in the driver's seat, and it was much quicker for her to go back to town than it was to go 7 miles to home because, you know, where Sheffield is and the bridge is, you know, you can walk it if you really wanted to. Mm-hmm. So she shot back to town. It was closer. People were there. She needed some help. So
because your mom was still not waking up, right?
Nobody was awake. Nobody was responding. So when she started to go back to Sheffield, Sheffield would have been on the side of the driver's side of the car now, but she's going back towards Connecticut. So she actually went back past the first entrance, went to the second entrance, turned around, and started going back towards Great Barrington or Sheffield again. And when she pulled right up in front of Silk Store, right up in front of it. And when she got out of the driver's door, which was like right to the door to Silk's, I think it was a door that slammed or something because by the time I came to, she was in front of the car just about to go into Silk's. Mm-hmm. And I woke up and I, Nana, and she saw that I was awake. So she kind of paused for a little bit, I guess, and kind of, I got out of the car and I got to her. And yet she still didn't like wait for me to get to her. She still walked in anyway, even though it was so strange because she wanted someone to respond to her, someone in the car to, you know, to be awake. So she goes for help. And then she sees that I'm actually up and somewhat responding. And yet she just walked in anyway. It was really weird. Then she actually walked right by the clerk, even though that's where she went for help. Right. Mm-hmm. And then she walks to the back of the store and they had bikes and strollers and stuff. And then when she got to the back, she started to come forward again and she got caught up in these strollers and she grabbed this baby, like a stroller, put her hands on it, and she started to rock it. I don't say it too often, but...
Oh.
And then, so I'm going to her and I'm grabbing her hand. I'm like, Nana, Nana. But I'm pulling her over like a bike and I'm trying to get her, I'm trying to pull her right through these bikes. None of this made sense. We were all just like...
completely disoriented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then she finally comes around and stops at the clerk again to, I'm thinking, going to ask for help, but no paramedics ever showed up, no police, nothing. And there's a little exchange and we walk back out. My mother was now out of the car and she was awake. We get in the car and drove home. And so the next morning, and we had been talking about the UFO topic in town, these sightings and what took place with our family for quite some time. So when we opened up the following morning and people were coming in for breakfast, we started to hear over the radio all the reports that came in, you know, from, you know, people that, you know, not so much Melanie, but those other people who had seen it in Great Barrington and Stockbridge and a lot of the reports that had come in the night before. Tom Jay was actually had them on the air and they were calling, you know, talking about what was this we saw. And so a lot of people tend to say to us, you know, well, 69 must have been horrible for you, you know, all that happening. It actually was a reckoning in a way because so many other people were now seeing what we had been talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, it was almost like we weren't the only ones anymore. And as it come to find out, we weren't the only ones in 67 either. So Melanie had experiences before 69.
Interesting.
And this is something I want to mention too because I never really talk about this. I remember going to school and drawing what we saw. Actually, the picture I drew was actually in the Roswell Museum. So I drew the UFOs, and I drew the water and all this kind of thing, and I taped it to the bottom of, you know, the lip for chalk on a chalkboard? Mm-hmm. I taped it to the chalkboard lip. And other kids had drawn what they saw. So back in Sheffield, we were hardly the only ones to have seen this prior to 69. A lot of other people, children, were involved in this. Mm-hmm. And it's now coming out of all these other kids that are my age are now, yeah, I remember that, I saw it. But because their, you know, fathers or parents didn't want them talking about it, you know, it was crazy and it was stupid. It was nonsense back then. Not anymore. I mean, the Pentagon's releasing things. We all know we're not alone. Now we do. Lived in a box. And so that's why we came under so much fire. Being that we were outsiders, you know, from New York, we were, you know, outcasts and ended up having to move and the fights and all that. But part of, you want to say something?
I have a few questions.
Okay, so, yeah.
The first is, you know, you say other people had called the radio station, other people had seen this. Did anyone see the craft arrive? Like, did it come out from the sky? Did it come through a vortex?
Matter of fact, if you go to my website, you know, ufopark.org, though some of their testimonies from the Historical Society are actually on my website. So I would say that the majority of what people saw that night were multiple objects. Gina Paul and her sister Marissa, they were having remember it was Labor Day, so it was a holiday. So people were outside, barbecues, you know, a lot of people together that normally wouldn't have been together. And they were out later than normal. And kids, you know, no school, didn't get up for school the next day, so people were out at 8, 9 o'clock at night. Well, Gina Paul and her sister Marissa were looking out over Route 7 towards Great Barrington from the Sheffield area, the open fields. Now they got the marijuana dispensaries out there and everything. Off to the left, and she saw these lights just split apart from each other and form different groups of, you know, whatever it is, you know, just, you know, creating different patterns and shapes and separating. She saw all that, and she lived on our street. We used to take the school bus together. And so then, of course, Jan Green basically just saw the thing hovering there silently. Now, my brother remembers something like a woo, 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 woo sound. I don't remember that, but he does. And then Tom Jay, one of the reasons, I don't know if you know this, remember in Unsolved Mysteries, they said, oh, well, we don't think we have the tapes. Well, that's not entirely true. When Tom Jay left the radio station or was leaving, he had made copies according to his wife, who's still alive today. So when Tom Jay, the disc jockey, lost his life or passed, there was a box of things that were sent to his family in Arizona. And there is a very good chance that there is a copy of those reports in Arizona. As far as the radio station's copies, yes, those were, you know, reused, you know. Mm-hmm. But when Tom Jay, see, the radio station was actually off air at 5 o'clock, so he had gone home. And because Tom Jay, the radio personality for WSBS Radio, who announced this the following day, he was a ham operator, and he heard people on the ham radio seeing this thing. So he left his home, went back to the radio station, got on the air, and said, hey, guys, you know, where is this thing? That's why the police reports, they said, oh, they weren't police reports. Remember that? Well, people were calling the radio station rather than the police department because he got back on the air and said to call the radio station.
Oh, interesting.
And the incident didn't really happen in Great Barrington. The incident really happened in Sheffield, aside from Melanie. But now look at this too, right? Because Melanie ran into it at 8 o'clock, about 8 o'clock. Again, in a car, four people near the water, and it was going towards Sheffield. So when we ran into it, we were both, our whole family were gone out of that vehicle. The same time Melanie was gone. Mm-hmm. So Melanie and our family, we were gone at the same time. And so when Tom Jay had gotten on the air, just prior to that happening, he had said, hey, where is this thing? That drove Jan Green to leave Stockbridge and drive all the way to WSBS to knock on her door and say, you know, I saw it. It's right there. So this incident back in the day wasn't something passive where people just said, oh, I saw it. People responded. Galata got in the police car with his father from the Sheffield Police Department and went looking for it.
Wow.
So that shows you the power this had over this community. It wasn't like, oh, people just saw something. Oh, you know, whatever. There's no police reports. Forget about it. I can't believe the Great Barrington officer said that because, A, it was a holiday. It was a binder, a ring binder. Anyone could have taken that page out. But you don't have a holiday in a town like Great Barrington where people are drinking and riding horses and all this stuff, and you don't have but one report of beer cans? Come on.
Right.
When Sheffield, remember Galata was on the show, and he's like, oh, my father, first he thought it was a bunch of baloney. Remember that? Mm-hmm. But he actually got into the police car with his dad, remember? And they went looking for it. Mm-hmm. So if it's going to drive, a smaller community gets flooded with calls to the point where the officer gets in his car with his son, goes looking for this thing, but Great Barrington goes, oh, no, nothing here. Come on. Yeah, what a bunch of nonsense. You know what I mean? So that kind of, I don't know. Anyway. So what's your next question? I'm sure you got more.
My next question is about the extraterrestrials. So you said they kind of had like an ant head and they're like bamboo. And how tall were they?
Well, here's the thing. I don't know if you've ever seen an image that I had made, a depiction. I drew it when I was a kid and I had it turned into a okay. When I saw this thing, my brother saw it too, it wasn't much bigger than us. And we were, but I was like 9, but it was squatting. It wasn't like it was standing up like a person. You know, the legs were bent like a grasshopper. So when I saw these two, you know, I don't know if they were alive. I don't know if they were robotic. I don't know if it was a combination. I don't know. But it definitely could have probably extended up to 7 feet.
When I saw it,
it had the legs bent like an A, you know, and the body. And, you know, my brother and I talked about this too. He's like, well, maybe they were shorter because we were little. It was less arming to us. Or was it just that's how they sat or stood because they could have been much taller, you know, if they had extended themselves. And you know, I don't talk about that much because it is so bizarre. You know what I mean? Like a lot of people talk about, you know, gray aliens and the big almond eyes and everything. This had like round little eyes, like a snake, you know, like that deep black marble round. The head, even though in my drawings it looks kind of gold, it was almost like a translucent, like a fire ant. And, you know, people said, well, did it have human hands? Did it, you know? And because I was grabbed by my arm, and from what I kind of remember as a kid, I had human hands on it. I don't know if that's 100% accurate. It's the best. I don't want to put something weird on it, right? I'm trying to think of how, you know, because it did have human characteristics. It did turn its head. It did seem to be intelligent. I don't know. I've never really known anyone else to see anything quite like it. You know, and I try to be honest. I have to be honest with myself and everyone else that I was scared. So because I was a child, I was frightened. Did I make it more scary than I needed to? You know, like someone had said to me once, you know, you watch a horror flick and someone knocks on your window and you're like, what? Right? But it doesn't necessarily mean that it was meant to scare you, right? But you get scared.
Yeah.
I try very hard to keep this into perspective, you know. I was young. But the other thing, too, is like my brother saw it and this all happened to our family at once. It wasn't like it was just, you know, by myself. And then, you know, there were other things that happened afterwards. I mean, there were other sightings in the area. Even in Great Barrington, there was that orangey-looking sphere. It was also seen in Great Barrington near a park in 1974. So this is something that happens a lot and in the area. And I'm willing to bet when you went to the park, did you feel – you're sensitive too, right? You can pick up on things. Okay. Did you feel anything weird there? Because a lot of people do. They say it's kind of like heavy air, you know, something –
It was a little. It was a little heavy. I thought, you know, when we were there, it was a little heavy. I thought it was sort of strange, like some of the things that were kind of happening. Like a woman showed up and took like 2 photos and then just like walked away. But it was like she like deliberately showed up to be there, and then like there was this pack of small dogs there. And
did she take pictures of you?
No, just like of like the plaque. But she kind of kept like looking at us a little weird, and I don't know. My boyfriend was there. He told me I was reading too much into it, but it did. It did. It felt a little heavy. Is a good word. Heavy is a good word.
Yeah. So, and at night, it gets a different. Well, the park is coming along, and I'm really happy about that.
It's beautiful. And the whole area is just lovely.
You know, one of the things that I want to get clear, I don't know how much time I have, but how much time do I have left?
As long as you want.
You're awesome. Okay. So what I would say is I want to make this clear too, because it's a Massachusetts, you based in Mass. We did have a tough time there. There's no doubt. Okay. And so did a lot of other people, you know. And what happened to that community is this. And Melanie, if you ever have her on the show too, you should have her on. She's great. People's personalities simultaneously changed and went in different directions. And there were the Melanies, us, and some others that sort of, I wouldn't say separated ourselves, but no longer was interested in throwing a ball around or doing the silly, stupid stuff that kids do, playing ball. I used to sit on top of my parents' stable and just look out over the fields and at the sky. And my mother said to me once, you know, what do you want, you know, for Christmas, your birthday, you know? And I told her a camera. And that's helped my, that drove my career from that point on, you know? But that's what I was interested in. I wanted to get pictures of this stuff. And I started to walk around with, I was starting to have this connection with the horses, you know? Later on, I had a tiger, you know, I've always had this, I had a raccoon.
Hold on.
I had a tiger. Yeah, I had a 270-pound Siberian tiger.
A Siberian tiger.
Yeah, I used to pet it. Yeah, it was in my backyard.
Where were you living?
Florida.
Oh my goodness! Yeah. Oh.
You know, I used to own Miami Models, right?
I did know that. That I knew. Yeah.
I did some shoots with it and stuff like that. Oh. And I did some. You know, my son's football team, Raiders Gone Wild, and I used it for that. But yeah, I had a guy come over with a big cardboard box and four tiger cubs in it. He goes, "You want one?" I'm like, "Yeah." It was sold.
without going too far off topic, but you weren't involved in that whole Tiger King ring of people, right?
It probably came from the guy in Miami, because it came from Miami.
Okay.
Yeah, you can see it online. I mean, you can pull up Miami Models Tiger on YouTube. You'll see it.
Wow.
So anyway, so I guess what I'm saying is I've always, ever since then, I didn't get along so much with the people in the area, but I had this thing with horses and animals. I just found like I connected more with nature, and I was just totally going in this different direction. I no longer believed in, you know, I wasn't into the whole God and Christ and church thing anymore. It was all a bunch of nonsense to me, and I felt like I was lied to, and I had all these weird things going on, and I was like, when you see something like that, it just clarifies so much in a matter of a day, right? Your whole life has changed forever. By the time it took me to go from one side of that bridge to the other, I was a different person. And so that also changed other people, though. Like Melanie kind of went in the same direction I did, yet her parents, you know, couldn't accept it, you know? So she was isolated from her own parents, right? But my parents experienced it with me. And so when we were in a diner, the other kids that were having these experiences or had seen things and had upfront and personal contact like we did, you started to see that in the kids' eyes back then. And so because the community shifted and the fight started to break out is how our case made history. It's because of that division that made history, because they had shown that that our diner had altered the natural progression of the community. And we divided the community. Our incident had divided and changed an entire community. Therefore, the event was historically true. That's kind of how the whole thing happened. Even now, you're starting to see more and more people coming forward that weren't allowed to talk about it before. And so that's what the park is for. You know, my idea for the park was to You know, once this got inducted, it was like I wanted to do something for everyone else, you know, that went through what we did, you know. And I was thinking to myself, how do I get the interest of it? How do I get people to accept it. And because, you know, even now, there's some people in town that don't like the topic, you know, trying to take them on. So I, you know, I was able to get Travis and some other people to sponsor a bench in the Roswell Museum. And you know, that kind of brought some attention to it, and it got the papers to mention it. And now people, you know, so now I've got this park that is really for the community. It's not for me. I don't live anywhere near there. Mm-hmm. And to me, the idea behind it was to have a judgment-free area, you know, whatever it is, whether it's UFOs or, you might have been picked on for or questioned or wrongly judged or, you know, that's what this park is for, you know?
That's really nice. I like that.
That's what I'm trying to, nice. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, but I don't think people get it, you know? Like I've got my friend in Florida's 16-year-old kid's transgender, you know? Kid goes through hell, you know? You know, it's nobody else's business. I mean, I don't think, you know, when so many people saw what they did in Sheffield, these people weren't lying. These people weren't making this up. And yet you had your own family members, you know, pushing you aside. That was hard. And kids can be mean, you know, yeah. Kids can be mean today. So that was the idea behind the park was to give people a place where they could just, you know, talk and meet other people like themselves, you know. And it also brought in some television shows, which is really cool for the area, you know. Mm-hmm. And so now my idea is, well, wait a minute, because I got some contacts in film, if I bring in a show, now I can get their voices, these people that were pushed aside for years. Now it's time for them to take the microphone and say what they got to say. Because, yeah, maybe we lost some battles, but we're going to win the war, right?
Yes.
And that's the idea behind the park. We're going to win the war.
That's incredible. I love that. That's very nice.
Thank you.
That's great. There's a couple other questions I wanted to ask. And the first is, so I know you are now in, I don't know what to call it, like the UFO circuit, and you know Travis Walton and all these other people. And when you get together with other people who have had similar experiences, has anyone seen the same type of extraterrestrial that you have seen?
No. A lot of people, though, or the general census is that, you know, it was a form of the ant people, you know?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And when I said it looked like an ant, the reason I said that it looked like an ant to me is because the head of it looked like an ant. The body certainly didn't, but the head did. You know, we get into these conversations about, well, you know, we're already breeding animals and extracting certain genes, and we're playing around. So what we saw was probably nothing more than just a new life form, you know, a new way to, you know, cross this with that. You know, Travis and, you know, they're like, oh, you know, an ant can carry 100 times its weight. You know, that's something that keeps coming up to me. And so if you were to have some species that you needed to work on a craft or be a worker type of being, well, then, yeah, you'd want the genetics or the gene, or you'd want to extract some of that from an ant, because a 60-pound ant could carry a Volvo across the street, right? And apparently they have pockets in them that open up. They can trap air and echo. You could flick an ant out in space and go back 3 days later and be fine. So,
really?
They trap water and air in the pockets of their bodies. They're very weird and unique animals or insects, I guess. And so when I first said it looked like an ant, the more I hear about it, you know, other people sharing their thoughts that this would almost make sense. The more I say, yeah, I guess it was a form, you know, a hybrid form of an ant. And then, of course, it's like they say to me, you know, like Barr or else, well, how big is the average bird? And I'm like, well, the average bird's, what, 2 feet long. Yet back in the day, pterodactyls had 36-foot wingspans, right? So mm-hmm. is it whatever, was it that big or 13, whatever, but they were big friggin' birds. So just because we get comfortable with something here doesn't necessarily mean that that's, you know, that there are other, again, species within a species that is much bigger. And so I used to struggle with the fact of what I saw reminding me of an ant and how could it be so big, but in retrospect, maybe it's not that far-fetched. And then I look at the fact that our Earth has had multiple extinctions. I mean, we've had, even one extinction or two extinctions, you'd think this planet would be basically desolate, right? But we've had seven. And wow. So this planet has had seven extinctions, yet we have over 8 million species here. Think about that. And then out of that 8 million, for them to thrive, there has to be couples. And if there was only one male, one female, that would be risky anyway, because if one died or was attacked or whatever, that species would immediately die out. So there would have to be pockets. It would have to be a couple males, a couple females, the same age and placed at the same location so that they would see each other so that they could have offspring. So after seven extinctions, theoretically, we would have had to have 64 million, couples here. Mm-hmm. And they're all placed at the exact spot where they would need to thrive, right? Giraffes are where they need to be, polar bears are where they need to be. We have brackish water, fresh water, salt water, the desert, the rainforest. It's our Earth rotates on a unique axis. So all these species can flourish together at the same time. So to me, Earth is like our galaxy's arc.
Interesting.
And I think that's why there's an interest in water. Where Melanie was near water, we were near polluted water, because without water, we all die. So I was thinking that maybe there's a connection, because there does, at least in that area, even the Hudson River sightings were over water, right? Mm-hmm. The New England sightings are mostly all over water.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is kind of happening. So when we get together and I talk with Mike or Travis or whatever, that's kind of where we go is, at least me, that's my... where I go with it. And then of course the ant thing, it's like, well, it almost makes sense. I mean, we are making ligers, we're taking spiders and crossing it with cows and making spider silk.
Yeah.
You know, we've got jellyfish can go back in time and become young again. You know, so you have all these little abilities. So yeah, who's to say that there isn't just a lot of gene tampering and what you saw was a product of that.
You know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's worth thinking about. Yeah, for sure.
Something to think about.
And then my next question is, like, so much stuff is coming out about UFOs right now, what the government knew or didn't know. I feel like I'm always joking with people saying, like, imagine how much money the government has spent covering up UFOs. Thinking, and what everyone always used to say was like, well, if people knew there were UFOs, they would just freak out. Like, we wouldn't be able to handle it. And now the government's like, there are UFOs, and society at large is like, eh.
Yeah. All right. Right.
Yeah. Of course there are UFOs.
we knew that. It's fun. So, yeah. You know, a big person, I'm wondering if you have talked to this person or if you, because it is so strange to me and to everyone else, but Tom DeLonge of Blink 182, does he have some real influence with any of this?
You know, I've never spoken with him, but apparently he's doing some good. I mean, yeah, absolutely. But as far as how is he getting his information a little bit early and that kind of thing, I don't know. But I think it's really we are in a changing time, and I think that's where you're going too. We've got so many people coming forward that it's almost like everybody's jumping on the bandwagon now. You know, it's been people like Travis and me and all these people all these years fighting to get or be heard, and everybody just throws stones. But now that it's out, everybody's like, I always knew.
Right?
It's kind of like, yeah, exactly. And I think that, you can't hide it anymore. There's too many cameras. There's too many things happening. My father, my father's attorney, or our family's attorney, actually took this to the United Nations in 1992. I don't know if you know about that. The forms and the papers that came back from that meeting, I've had, my God, I've had them since, probably 1999. And even in these documents that we have from the United Nations back then, it talks about, it goes all the way back, talking about UFOs to 1974. 1974 was a big year for the United Nations and recognizing this topic. And even in these reports, that shows, you know, that the Greece Ministry of Defense, the Air Force was paralyzed to fire upon a UFO. It's all in black and white, right from the UN minutes. And so why they try to cover it up, I don't know. I don't think people are going to panic about that. Are you panicking?
No.
I'm not panicking.
No. I mean, I'm panicking, but not about that.
Yeah. There's other things to worry about.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think religion played a big part in it. I think to control our country, you have to have a fear factor, you know? And I think, of course, religion falls into that a little bit. Was that one of the main reasons? I don't know. I think that whoever back engineers a craft first or technology first is going to basically control the entire world, right? So I think it's more about, keeping things quiet. Hypothetically, let's say 30 years ago, we found out that Iran had a crashed craft, right? Or they were going to back engineer a UFO. Russia, the United States would all be freaking out, right? What are they going to do with that technology, right? It gives them way too much power. So I think it's about power, you know, and money, you know, so money, power, greed, is more important with regard to the silencing than, you know, the spin that they put that people are going to panic or it's about religion. It's about greed and money. And at this point, I think that there's so much out there and so much knowledge here or so much awareness that it's just at this point we have to start leaking it a little bit because people already know the government knows. I mean, they're already cornered. It has to come out now. These next couple of years are going to be amazing. Yeah. Look at this too. Do you really think our government gives NASA trillions of dollars because they haven't found anything?
That's a good point too.
That's a good point.
You know? Yeah. I mean, if you don't produce at work, your days are numbered. You know, sure they put up some satellites now and then, but there's an awful lot of private companies that could do that also. Mm-hmm. You know? So I think it's just time, and we're going to see some big changes, I think, in the next 3 or 4 years. I need to get my book out. You know, for 5 years, I probably should get a book out. You know, and that's another thing. I don't make money on this. You know, like I'm in the circuit a little bit, not so much like other people. I'm more in the mainstream side of it. You know. I talk to the Globe once in a while or something like that. But, I'll do a Dragon Con or, I speak at the Roswell Museum or, Arizona now and then. But, I don't have a table where I'm selling merchandise and all that kind of thing. It's never been about money to me. It's been about bringing awareness, you know, and how my father lost his life on the same day that this went to the United Nations, you know. And I had some contacts in film and television because of Miami Models. And I thought, well, maybe I could, reopen the death of my father's case. It's kind of how this whole thing started with my brother and I, you know. But, of course, you know, it became more of a circus than anything else, you know. Oh, you think your father was killed over a UFO? You know what I mean. And but at the same time, I think we've we've been able to contribute to this topic rather than extract from it, you know. And that's to me, that's more important. I would rather leave this world and know that I contributed something and that we were able to bring awareness and offer something rather than just, like so many others, capitalize on it. You know, I got a limo company. I do fine. You know, I don't need to run around selling paperbacks. So, you know what I mean? But I do need to have one written that will preserve the truth behind this. because if you watch Discovery, they put a different spin on it. If you watch Ancient Aliens, they show the coned ice cream thing. You know, they don't show the craft, you know. And so somewhere along the line, you know, there has got to be, okay, this is what happened. You know what I mean? Soup to nuts, you know. And really even focus on the park and how greed played a part in it towards the end, like right now, at least with a few people. But, yeah, it's long overdue. And now that there's so many other witnesses, I talked to Melanie from Unsolved. She's going to be in my book. We're going to put her into it, you know.
Great.
Yeah, so I'm pretty excited about that. So there was this nonsense that I put the monument there. Did you hear that? Okay. I didn't have anything to do with it. Never touched it. Didn't build it, didn't pay for it, nothing. So back in 2015, New England Legends, you know, Jeff Bellinger and them from New England. Okay. They came in Sheffield and they were gonna do a show on, you know, on the park and the monument, I guess. The park really wasn't built yet, but the spot that was gonna be a park. Anyway, ABC News came in from Albany. And I was asked to come into town, so I did. I drove back 900 miles, because I live outside of Atlanta, you know. So I show up, you know, Jeff's there, you know, everybody's hanging out. I'm like, wow, this is awesome. And they said, yeah, you've got a monument. They're going to unveil it live with ABC News. So the monument that night, Jeff and I are hanging out, driving around with Jeff, John, where we were leaving from. We get to the park, and bang, the monument's there. Right? The monument, the first time I saw the monument, it was at the park. First time I really laid eyes on it.
Wow.
And so Jeff films it. It's actually in his episode. And so then about 2 weeks later, we find out that apparently Nadine and Rhonda, who had the Department of Public Works install it, didn't have the authority to make that decision. Mm-hmm. So they lied, basically. They lied about doing it. But because I live 900 miles away, they never thought I'd get news that they went to the papers and said they didn't do it. But once they jumped in with both feet, they had to stick to their story. Mm-hmm. So they said they didn't put it there and they were going to, but they moved it now. Now they moved it to another location further back. And so because I was a benefactor of the monument, I was copied in these emails from Copeland and Page, the law firm in Boston, and their attorney, Mark Reich. And the Pine Island Farms, they gave a letter to the town of Sheffield, and that letter went to their law firm. And once they had the location picked out between the town, the attorney, and the farmer, then I was made aware that the monument would be moved into this new spot. Not because it was, you know, my monument to begin with, but because I was a benefactor. So they moved it and installed it. Mm-hmm. And that was through the Department of Public Works. Eddie Ward actually moved it there with a forklift, I guess. So anyway, shortly after that, again, oh, we didn't do that. So this is twice now the town of Sheffield said they didn't install it when they did, they installed it themselves. The same people that say they didn't do it are actually the ones who installed it. That's how crazy it is. So... So then, even though this went through a letter from the owner to say this is private property, you can put it there, once it became touristy, once people started showing up, once people were starting to go walk through the bridge again and with their dogs, and lots of dogs. Yeah. It's lots of, right? You gotta watch where you step these days. right, so... Once it became a tourist attraction, right, or a destination spot, now Sheffield's going, or certain people, not the town of Sheffield. Sheffield's not a bad town. It's a good town. It's a lot, certain people in the town, within the town. So these certain individuals are like, wait a minute. You know, we're onto something here. How do we get our hands around this? How do we get some control over it, right? And I can see anybody in a town hall saying, you know, they're eating lunch. They're going, hey, man, we got to get, you know, how do we get control of this thing? How can we, you know... You know, be able to put a hot dog wagon in there, sell ice creams, right? So the way to do that was to make a claim that they still had a right of passage because there used to be a road there. But being that you were just there, you know damn well that road has been closed off.
Right,
and it's been closed off for 26 years.
Wow.
So according to Massachusetts or the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the way they categorize that road now, it's what they refer to as a paper road. It means that on paper, it could be a road, but because the road is not easable, because two cars can't get around each other, if they meet in the middle, one's got to back up, what, half a mile?
Yeah.
So it's not easable. So they shut the county, shut down the road, not Sheffield. The bridge is maintained by the county, not even the town of Sheffield. Sheffield doesn't have say over that bridge. It's not maintained by them. It's a county. Any bridge over a body of water in Massachusetts is maintained by the county and state.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So Sheffield said, well, we still have our right of passage. Now, you're smart. If I wanted to, or you wanted to cut through somebody else's yard to get to, you know, land that you have somewhere else, just because someone says to you, you can cut through my driveway and drive up past wherever you need to, and I give you a right of passage, that doesn't mean that over a year's time that becomes your property.
Right.
And that's what Sheffield tried to do. They were like, well, we still have a right of passage, even though it's been closed off for 26 years. Well, even if that's so, that right of passage is granted to you by the landowner, right? Mm-hmm. That doesn't make it Sheffield's land. So when they put those boulders there that you saw blocking the road, you can't do that. That's not their land. That's private property. They have a right of passage, but that's not, doesn't give them the right. You cannot, you can't give me the okay to cut through your lawn and then I put five boulders in it across your yard, right?
Right.
It's a, you're extending me a courtesy. So the landowner was giving the town a courtesy to use that road or passage, you know, 30 years ago. But because the bridge is blocked off, there is no more road.
Right.
So Sheffield tried to say, well, we still have a right of passage. And the reason they went with that was because then they could remove that monument without it having to go through the normal steps of a town meeting. So they basically said, well, it's on town property. Without permission, we can just take it like it's stolen property or abandoned property, however they want to look at it, without ever admitting to anyone else within the town now, because it's been 5 years later, that they're the ones who put it there. So the other people in the town hall have no idea who actually put it there, because they've been lying to everyone else in the town hall for 5 years.
Interesting.
But if you go to my website, you'll see all the, it's all there. I know that was a very long-winded, you can probably edit whatever you want out, but that's, you know.
I'm keeping it.
Okay. Yeah. All right, good.
I
but
like
that's
it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the bench. So the bench, listen to this. You want to hear what this woman, this Nadine and Rhonda. Blah. So this local woman who I used to know as a kid, right? Her name was Karen Hankey. Her husband was a friend of mine back in the day. And when he died, very young, she decided rather than do something, you know, typical like anyone else would do, she was going to sponsor a bench in my park and put his name on my bench because we were friends. You know, they saw it, their friends saw it. And so it was a nice way to say, hey, you know, it's right behind my house. I knew Tom growing up. He would have liked this. My late husband would have liked this. So she buys a bench, or shares a bench with Shockwave Motors, electric car manufacturer. And because she's in, it's like Jingra's Lawn and Garden, she has all these decorative stones and rock. She went and got pickup trucks full of decorative stone and did this beautiful spread there and put her bench on it. And we chained it down and made sure that it wasn't permanently affixed. So if you wanted to get around it or it was weeds, they could pick it up and move it a little bit. You could shift it where you want. Do you know the town not only took her bench? Now this came from Nadine and Rhonda, the same people who took the monument and the same people who actually installed the monument and said they didn't. They went into the park, not only took her bench, but they scooped up all her decorative stone and took her rock from the ground. That's how vindictive these people are.
That's cold.
They took her. What's wrong with decorative stone? And the reason was, well, we have a rite of passage, and the bench and the monument infringed on our passage. Infringed does not mean it's on your right of way. The stone certainly isn't going to stop a fire truck. You know what's going to stop the truck from going through the park? Those boulders you put there. Not her little decorative stones. None of it makes sense. And it's all about rebranding. Huh. It's all about rebranding that park. Taking the monument with my name on it, removing the benches, anything that they can, so that they could put, or the thinking of a particular two people or three people, was to put a new sign in there and call it Sheffield's Berkshire's UFO Park. The idea behind what's happening is not that they don't like it. It's bringing in tourism.
Yeah, they want to make money off of it.
Right. And how do you do it? You can't do it by having my name associated to everything. That's what it's about. And there's other people that were actually in. There's actually somebody else that was in that episode with me, who was part of that. I'm not going to mention any names.
Righto. Beth, what were you saying?
Tom, do you own that land that the park is on?
I lease it. I have a lease agreement.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, cool. I don't lease very much of it. I was there with a guy by the name of Mark Lavoy. He used to be the vice president of Parks and Recreation for the state of Massachusetts. And we walked off a little area. And where that park stops at the last bench and that grass comes out to the water, I actually have rights all the way to the end where it circles around. So I got a lot more space than I use, you know. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to have to mow any more than I, you know, like I said, it's just a spot for people to feel like they can say and talk and share whatever they want without being judged. That's all it is, you know.
But, and it's beautiful. I've been. It's beautiful. I give it an A+ as far as parks go.
Thank you. Oh, by the way, there's more going in.
Okay.
My latest sponsor, you know, disc golf, you know, disc, like Frisbee has a disc golf.
Yes.
There is a disc golf basket being donated by Quest AT Golf. Whoa. And you know the sign? This is really cool. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You know the sign in the front? That's being made into a Frisbee.
Oh, it's very cool.
A professional disc golf. So we're getting a run of five. Yeah, disc golf. You know what that is, right?
It's Frolf, yeah. Frisbee golf.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for people who don't know, they have different weights, different frisbee, you know, like golf clubs, right? So you ever heard of the Turbo Putt by Quest AT? It's a very sought after disc golf Turbo Putt.
No.
So that Turbo Putt isn't round on the outside. It's kind of got this bevel thing going on. So he's like, man, that looks just, you know, it looks like we'd like to rebrand our Frisbee and get our disc golf disc and get it back out there. And it looks just like your sign. So would you be interested in working with us on a launch of 5,000 of these new disc golf, you know? I'm like, let me think about it. Yeah. So they are making 5,000 of those. And then the long distance disc is going to be fluorescent green. And it's going to have a little UFO monument park written on it, but the disc itself is going to glow. So I've got, I got two Frisbee going to be packaged together. And so that's going to be released, I guess, in about 2 to 3 weeks. Yeah.
Let us know how we can order it, because I want one of those.
Yeah. Actually, the Berkshire Eagle is doing a story on it right now.
Okay.
And a woman, her name is Jennifer, who's doing the article.
Uh-huh.
And I could probably get you her contact information, and you could probably – she's doing a story on it.
Great.
Cool. Yeah. Maybe get her on the air or something. Yeah.
Awesome. I love it.
Yeah, me too. It's pretty cool. I am working right now. I am filming another show at the park. We've got to put it on hold because of COVID. But Travel Channel is filming in Great Barrington and Sheffield. And I'm also working with one of the ex-producers of Inside Edition out of Toronto, Canada. And I think it looks like they're going to be doing a 6 to 9 week miniseries. And they're going to be filming in Sheffield as well. So there's a lot of attention. I spoke to Osborne Productions, Ozzy Osborne's son, Jack. And they're interested in doing something as well. So there's an awful lot of shows and opportunities for local people to now be heard, to have a voice. And so I'm really excited about that as well. So not to take up any more of your time, but I thought I'd mention that as well. So,
of course. Actually, I do have one more question for you.
Okay.
Do you have time for one more question?
I'm not in a rush to go anywhere. All I'm right, having a coffee with you guys.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
Mm-hmm. You want to hear something crazy?
Yeah.
Yes.
What I told you wasn't crazy enough? This is going to sound absolutely nuts, but you guys remember A Death in Canaan, the Peter Riley trial? Barbara Gibbons, the big murder in Canaan, Connecticut?
Nope.
Oh, my God. You got to Google that. Just Google A Death in Canaan. Brian Dennehy and Susan St. James were in the movie.
Okay.
It's one of Connecticut's only unsolved murder cases. After we left Sheffield, after all this happened, and we decided it was time to get out of town, my father decided that he was going to take his bar in Connecticut because he didn't think he'd ever get, you know, elected as a mayor or what have you. He was a lawyer and an attorney and mayor. And he decided to move to Canaan, and he bought this property where this murder took place.
Wow.
And and so there were, you know, shadow type things, cold spots in the house, you name it, all kind of activity. But it was a famous, it's a famous case, The Death in Canaan.
Whoa.
And look it up. I mean, if you got a second, look it up. I mean, I'll wait. A Death in Canaan, because it's right in your backyard. And it's only about, I don't know, maybe 5 miles from the park. And it's one of the most famous unsolved murder cases in the state of Connecticut. And we lived there. And I used to go to that house where the murder took place. This woman was slit up the middle, basically cut in half. And I took some things out of the cottage where she was found dead. I still have them in my house today.
Wow. Okay, so I got the summary right here. Based on real events, the film focuses on Connecticut teenager Peter Riley, who was arrested on the charge of violently murdering his mother. Although Peter signs a confession, he later withdraws it, claiming he was unclear about the process, which involved a lie detector test. Taking up Peter's cause, the people of the town, most notably writer Joan Barthel, played by Stephanie Powers, decided to support their local boy and seek to have his case reopened.
Yeah, so we lived in that house. So after this happened, we ended up buying the house. The cottage that they lived in where she was killed was actually an early 1900s post office.
Wow.
Or late 1800s post office. And so they rented that cottage on this land with a house and a barn. And so my father bought the whole spot, the whole thing. And of course the kids were where they want to hang out, right? The cottage and all that kind of thing. And it was the strangest thing. And I think because we're sensitive anyway, you know, we would see shadows of things, you know, move across the wall, hearing footsteps. And I still to this day am very sensitive like that. And my son has a lot of abilities, you know, heightened abilities. Mm-hmm. So you wonder, where did this come from? Did something happen when I was a child with the UFO part of this that has stayed with me since? Or
is it your blood type?
Yeah, are all of these happenings because you are who you are?
Right. See, I don't know. I have no idea. But I do know that I changed immensely after this 67 incident.
Mm-hmm.
I was 7 years old, and I think at that point there was a shift with me personally, my not just my beliefs, but my personality. You know, this connection to animals, you know. Like I said, I don't want to drag this on too much longer, but when I was about 9 or 10, I caught a wild raccoon. And I caught it with a cardboard box. It was sitting in there near where we used to have corn that we'd feed the horses. And I put a box over it, and I slid the box into like our I slid the box into like a pantry area and opened it up where the shoes were and all that kind of thing. And for whatever reason, I mean, I never touched it or anything, but I opened a door to our house and it walked in our living room. And it kind of hung around our garage, and I wasn't scared of it or bothered it. It wasn't scared of me. And we just kind of, it was the craziest thing. And I think because of the eyes of the thing too, I was kind of intrigued, you know, the black markings around the eyes, and I was just kind of drawn to it. But it was almost like an odd pet of sorts, you know? Mm-hmm. And after that I ended up, had a wolf. I had I had a full blown tiger. I had an Asian leopard. I had a nice bengal cat. I had parrots, you know, you name it. I mean, and always had this thing for animals. And you know, the tiger too, you know, a lot of people are really shocked about that. That tiger was probably as mellow as anything. I mean, it got a metal bucket stuck on its head one day in Florida, and it was blistering hot. The thing was going nuts because it had the water bucket got stuck on its head. And I mean, you couldn't touch it, you know, it was so hot. And so my son was like 10 years old, just spraying it down with a water hose to get it cold enough. He took a towel and just took it off its head. The thing wasn't defanged. It had claws. I mean, it could have shredded us. It was pissed off, but took it off, and then we watered him down. And my son sat in one of these big plastic lawn chairs, and the thing came up and flopped right over his feet and just hung out with him, laying right across his feet.
Wow.
I don't think I've ever been bitten by a dog. You know what I mean? I'm looking for a serval right now, or a Savannah cat is what I'd like to get now.
Cool.
But regular pets don't do it for me. I've always been kind of eccentric, I guess. Yeah, a little different. I'm just different. I'm a little different than most people. But I like being different, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting. You know, happy hour is always a good time. Get a couple drinks in me. Jesus Christ. You know what I mean? So, anyway, I hope to meet you guys in October.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, that'll be great.
Yes, we have to do that.
All right.
Thank you so much again. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me. All right.
Have a good night.
Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. What did you think of that, Beth?
That was really cool.
That was really cool. And I have, especially in like the last week leading up to this, listened to just so much about him, and I still feel like I learned a lot tonight.
Mm-hmm. I hadn't, in all the time that I'd been reading about what was going on and watching the different shows, never once had it been mentioned that he lived in a haunted house.
Or that he owned a tiger.
Being a ghost hunting podcast, I more asked that question more like as kind of like a joke, but then for him to be like, we lived in a haunted house. That's crazy. Like, that's amazing. So, that was really fun. I'm so glad that he took the time to talk with us and share all of that with us.
Yes. So thank you so much again to Tom Reed. Everyone make sure to check out his website, ufopark.org. And, any final words, Beth?
No, not this week. I do have final words. I'm sitting in my closet in my bedroom, very, very uncomfortably. So we're going to go through all of our wrap-up information super fast, right?
We could.
Or you could torture me by going really slow.
I could do that too.
I'm wondering if the sound quality is better this week.
We'll find out. Okay. So we would like to say thank you so much to Aaron Shilb for doing our music. You can check him out online at The Aaron Shilb. He has a single coming out this week. It is called The Millennials. If you're listening to our show the night it comes out, it is coming out this Friday, August 28th, and you can pre-order it online. You can find us. Our website is ghosthuntinginnewengland.com. Still has not been updated. You can find us on Instagram at ghosthuntinginnewengland. We got a very spooky Instagram message and photo, but we are out of time this week. We're going over it next week. Facebook.com/ghosthuntinginnewengland. Twitter, ghosthuntingne. Don't send your carrier pigeons anywhere because we are at a Somerville Media Center and we are doing this from home.
Email us, ghosthuntinginnewengland@gmail.com, with any of your drive-by ghostings. We haven't been getting many of those, have we? Do we have any yet this season?
Not this season, no. None.
Daniel, you're slacking, Daniel.
Daniel promised he would send some, and I want to send a huge just orb of energy love to Daniel, who is at home resting right now and has so much time now to work on his wonderful stories for us. And we just want to say get well soon, Daniel, and you have so much love coming to you from Boston right now.
Absolutely.
Feel better. So everyone, stay safe, stay well, tip your barista, and as always,
wear a mask when you go out anywhere, and happy hunting.
Good episode.